You know, for years we've been talking about the Illuminati, the push for a one-world government. We've talked about the Bilderbergs. We've talked about just what is going on behind the curtain. Up next, Daniel Estulin joins us again back on Coast to Coast with two of his works, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, which we've talked with him about in his brand new work, Shadow Masters. So get ready for something on Coast to Coast AM that will have you just shaking your head. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Daniel Estulin is one of the brightest stars on the world stage of fearless, no-holds-barred investigative journalism. He's the only man in the world to have infiltrated super-secret Bilderberg annual meetings and accurately predicted future events based on what he heard. And next week, Daniel will make history, being the first investigative journalist in the world to give an address on the Bilderberg Group in the European Parliament in Brussels. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Daniel, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for having me. Good evening to America and good morning to the rest of the world in Spain.
Always good to have you back on the show, Daniel. You're always busy, aren't you?
Well, you know, the Bilderbergers certainly keep my hands full, and with my new book, The Shadow Masters, being released all over the world, yes, you could say that.
Tell me about this address to the Bilderberg, about the Bilderberg Group to the European Parliament. How did that come about?
Well, you know, about 8 months ago, Mario Borghesio, one of the senior European politicians in European Parliament, think of him as Jesse Helms of Europe. He had come across my book, the Italian edition of my Bilderberg book, and he actually didn't know that these people existed. This is a 50-something-year-old man who was one of the key politicians in Europe over the last 30 years, one of the key decision-makers in the Italian government and European Parliament. And he had no idea that the Bilderberg Group, Society, Club, whatever you want to call it, that they actually existed. He was incensed. So with my Italian Bilderberg book in hand, he stood up in front of the European Parliament and asked who actually elected some of the individuals, such as Van Rompuy, the new president of the European Community. Who elected these people? And if it was a coincidence that the same individuals who seem to be running Europe had also be part of the Bilderberg Group. Then when I came to Italy on my Italian book tour in November, he came to see me and he asked me to join him for a presentation on Bilderberg Group in the European Parliament. I thought he was just, you know, speaking to the gallery, because this man, anywhere he goes, being so polemic, he's followed by a throng of Italian press. But actually, about 2 months later, this is the beginning of January 2010, I got a call from his secretary, and lo and behold, here we are next week, next Tuesday, I'll be speaking in front of the European Parliament, a historic event. I have no idea how many people will be there, but certainly I can tell you that Mario Borghesio will be there, and most likely Nigel Farage, the president of the British Independent Party, as well as a few other politicians from Italy and across Europe. Again, historic event. And Bilderberg, for the first time, has stopped being the, you know, the domain of the conspiracy theorists and the freaks who follow the one-eyed, you know, lizard people, that kind of order, and has become the, you know, the talk of the mainstream, which is exactly what we wanted to have it for, you know, for the past 20 years, which is as long as I've been following these people around the world.
Tell me a little bit about the Bilderberg Group. Explain who they are, what it is, Daniel.
Well, you know, Bilderberg isn't a secret society. There's no conspiracy, even though a lot of people would like to think of it as, you know, as an evil eye conspiracy of some of the world's most powerful people. It's a medium of bringing together financial institutions, which are the world's most powerful and most predatory financial interests. And at this time, it is that combination which is the worst enemy of humanity. Now, the Bilderberger organization, historically, was founded through the French Synarchist movement, which is a Freemasonic, Martinist, esoteric secret society. Now, the Synarchist movement, in turn, was founded as the oligarchy's counterattack on the principles upon which the United States of America was founded. Now, the Bilderbergers' aim is to carry out bloodless revolutions inspired by the upper classes, aimed at producing a form of government by technicians and technocrats, under which home and foreign policy will be subordinated to international economy. What's interesting about these people is that actually who makes up the Bilderberg Group? It's the old NATO alliance. You're talking about the presidents of every European nation, Canada and the United States, although it's true that the sitting president of the United States never attends because his every second of his time is very much accounted for. But again, he's well represented by others who represent the government. Then you have top 50, 60 CEOs of the leading corporations. You have the leading bankers, the United States Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, World Bank, International Monetary Fund. You have the congressmen and European commissioners. They're joined at this one long table by the leading lights of the world media, such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal, Le Monde from France, Grupo Prisa from Spain. And finally, you know, they're also at this big log table. You know, there's always room for the European royalty, which is a very important part of the Bilderberger history. It's not it's not just a decorative piece. The royalty is actually the key element, the cogs of the entire movement.
They've been there for a long, long time. Is it safe to say that this group is what we've always called the group that wants the New World Order?
Well, you know, that's a good question. Actually, it's a bit of a misconception in a way that, you know, Bilderberg, first of all, it's not a monolith, meaning that no group of people, I don't care how powerful they are, sit around a table holding hands, staring at a crystal ball, planning the world's domination. It's not so much about one world order, a new world government, you know, especially a lot of people point to the George H.W. Bush's speech back in the 1990s as kind of the key phrase to this, you know, towards this, you know, government control. It's actually, you know, it's a meeting of people who represent a certain ideology. And that ideology is rather one world company limited. It's the ideology of control by corporations at the expense of governments. And this is exactly what George Ball said back in the 1968 Bilderberger meeting in Canada, when he said, you know, how can we create the world where corporations one day shall give orders to governments? It's a very dynamic system, you know, in that it changes with the times, absorbs and creates new parts while excreting the remains of the decaying parts, such as, you know, Arthur Anderson, Enron. Members come and go, but the system itself, it has not changed. It is a self-perpetuating system, a virtual spider web of interlocked financial, political, economic, and industry interests with the Venetian ultramontane Fondi model at the center. Again, it's not about one world government, but rather one world company limited. And you know, just all you need to do is just have a look at Greece today.
Sure.
You have the International Monetary Fund, you have the World Bank, you have the European Central Bank, which are not, you know, the governmental institutions elected by the people, rather by the technocrats. They're actually telling, you know, a supposed sovereign nation of Greece what they must do in order to get their house in order. This is just an idea. You know, it gives you an example how it's not so much about the one world government, but rather one world company.
Why does it seem, Daniel, that countries like Russia, like Iran, maybe China, seem to be going not in tandem with the Bilderbergs, but opposite what they want? Why are they the rogues?
Well, because, well, that's actually a very good word, rogues. You know, anybody who is not with them is a rogue. Well, because these nations are actually not part of Bilderberg. The Bilderberg Alliance, this is your typical Anglo-American alliance of some of the most powerful, you know, banking houses in the world. This is, you know, what today is called the Bilderberg Group. Actually, 800 years ago already existed, and it was called the Venetian Black Nobility. You know, I spent 2.5 years investigating the roots of Bilderbergers in Florence and Italy. And I tell you, there are documents, which is why I can prove it historically, which is why the New York Times of this world have left me alone, because they know they cannot discredit me.
Right.
What's today called Bilderberg, 800 years ago already existed. It was the old Venetian Black Nobility. And Venice being Venice, it has nothing to do with Russia. It has nothing to do with China. It has nothing to do with Iran, although it is true that there are an occasional Russian and even Chinese representative who attended Bilderberg back in 2004 in Italy. But these are rogue elements. These are, you know, this is your typical fifth column. These are the individuals who are actually working against the interests of Russia nation state or China nation state, and again, against the interests and for the interests of the Bilderberger Club Alliance.
Do they create wars, Daniel?
Well, you know, that's a very tricky question because, you know, again, to believe that, you know, a small group of individuals, you know, control the, you know, the world events as in, you know, as if the rest of the world literally, you know, played to a tune of two or three people, you know, such as the isolated intentions of a small group of people. It's a Cartesian fantasy world of primitive minds. Rather, what you're looking at is the dynamics of social processes that shape the course of history as the movement of evolving ideas and themes over successive generations. So, for example, you know, what we're seeing today, you know, such as the in Europe, the destruction of nation states, whereas before we had, you know, countries in Europe. We had Spain, for example. I live in Spain, as you know. You know, we had our currency, which was called the peseta. We had our own constitution. Mm-hmm. We had our own borders, our own flag, you know, our own monetary policy. Right now, Spain doesn't have any of that. It's all dictated, you know, by the unelected officials from Brussels.
Sure.
So, you know, Spain has lost all of these. But again, it's not that someone said to someone else, go and take it away from them. It has been a very long and arduous process, which has literally gone on for over 600 years, going back to the 1439, you know, 1440 Council in Florence, where some of the great minds at the time, just before the Renaissance, have actually come together and said, you know, we can actually work together as nations and as people and actually do this for the betterment of humanity, you know, the concepts of common good, general welfare, you know, as written in the preamble to the United States Constitution. So, you know, it's not easy to create wars, but certainly when you have people who control key institutions in different nations, obviously wars is an easier thing to actually put together. And we're seeing some of the, you know, some of these conflicts such as Afghanistan today, you know, Iraq, you know, Iran, you know, something that the American Bilderbergers have been actually going after for a very, very long time. But European Bilderbergers, on the other hand, you know, like they keep saying, keep your hands off Iran. We don't want another, you know, mess on our back door.
And do you think that's going to happen, or do you think there's going to be something big with Iran? And I think maybe North Korea, Daniel.
Well, you know, the back in 2004, when a lot of people were making a lot of noise saying the war with Iran is imminent, I say, you know, the Iran war is off the table because European Bilderbergers, you know, back in Stresa in Italy, during the 2004 Bilderberger meeting, they told the American delegates point blank, don't even think about going into Iran after what you've done, you know, in Iraq and after the mess of Afghanistan. So, but now the way things stand, you know, if there is an attack, is because there are some crazy forces in Israel or in the United States, you know, who against all odds and against, you know, the betterment of judgment is actually willing to go to this war and no matter, you know, what happens as a consequence. So I don't know right now the way things stand because, you know, we are entering the end game. You know, what we're seeing right now, the wholesale destruction of the world economy. Again, you know, for people who don't understand, you know, how the dynamics of secret organizations actually work, you have to understand that, you know, there's a reason why the, you know, the world economy is being destroyed as we speak.
On
there's
purpose.
A reason why. Exactly. You know, and you tell a lot of people, they kind of roll their eyes and they look at you and they say, well, here you go again. But again, what, you know, their problem is that they simply don't understand history and they're accustomed to getting their news, you know, from the cover of the New York Times or the nightly news on ABC, NBC, or CBS, which is, of course, forms part of the world elite, which is one of the reasons you will never hear about Bilderberg Group. I mean, you go to Reuters and you do a, you know, a search on Bilderberg, there's one article, and when you try to access it, you know, it tells you the article doesn't exist. You know, and I think Bilderbergers exist. At least I've been following them around, you know, and I think Mario Borghesio thinks that they exist because I'll be giving a talk with him next week at the European Parliament.
Well, you know, I keep thinking about that movie Eyes Wide Shut. Did you ever see that?
It was, oh, of course. Okay. Yeah, of course.
I mean, to me, that is the Bilderbergs. It depicts how they live, their decadence, what they want, at the cost and expense of the average person. And I truly believe, Daniel, that this group, this power group, they won't stop until they get everything they want. Do you believe that this economic mess that is in the United States right now and now spreading throughout the world was caused by greed, or was it intentional to bring us down to our knees?
Well, you know, I think it's obvious that, you know, what we're witnessing right now is a very, you know, a long range conceived plan by you know, by men behind the curtain, the shadow masters. You know, these people want an empire. And, you know, too many people believe that in order to have an empire, you need money, you know, because we, you know, we're familiar with the phrase, you know, the money elite, right? But money is not a determinant of wealth, and money is not a determinant of the economy. Money doesn't affect the development of the planet. It has no intrinsic value. Human mind affects this development, and this is how mankind is measured. So what separates us from animals is our ability to discover universal physical principles. It allows us to innovate, which subsequently improves the lives of people. Now, the empire of money, what they want, and the empire of usury, is they want to dumb us down. And they need to dumb us down because what they need to do is they need to destroy progress and destroy development. Because long, long time ago, these people understood that development and progress is directly proportional to population density. The more developed we are, the more money we have, you know, the more sophisticated we are as a society, the more people we're going to have on the planet. And obviously, Rockefeller and company, when I say Rockefeller, I don't mean David Rockefeller himself. It's just a metaphor for powerful people.
Right.
They want to make sure that the natural resources of the planet, which they consider theirs, and they call us the great unwashed, although I have a shower every single day, at least once or twice a day, and I imagine you do too. You know, we're still, as far as they're concerned, the great unwashed. You know, and there's a lot of, again, when people talk about, you know, conspiracy theories and they kind of roll their eyes, again, all they need to do, for example, Club of Rome, which is kind of a, you know, a foreign policy arm of the Bilderbergers, they've put out a report back in 1973, you know, they're talking about zero growth, and the report was called Limits to Growth. You know, the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, which is the, you know, Bilderberger American version of American delegates, you know, they put out a report called the Project 1980s, promoting controlled disintegration of the world economy. And back in the 1990s, the Bilderbergers, they put out, you know, the Bilderberger reports where they were talking about, you know, about demand destruction. How? By destroying the world economy on purpose. Because, again, when we lose our wealth, our monies, our equities, our homes, you know, somebody else comes along and buys all of it for pennies on the dollar, just as in back in 1929 during the Great Depression, which really wasn't a Great Depression at all. It was simply a transfer of wealth because money is not water. It doesn't evaporate. You know, if somebody lost, such as you and I, somebody else came along and bought it, which is how Bank of America became Bank of America. You know, it has made all of its money back in the Great Depression days.
Yeah.
So this is what they're after. They're destroying the world economy on purpose because, again, they understand historically, intrinsically, and traditionally over the past 650 years, going back to the Council of Florence before the nation states, that in order to keep us dumbed down, they need to destroy our development as people, as nations. And this is exactly what they've been after for such a long time, which is why I say it's not like one or two people kind of pull the strings, you know, behind the scenes. It's rather dynamic, you know, dynamics of social processes which shape the course of history. And they've been at it for a very, very long time. And this is, you know, the whole idea of nation state republics disappearing instead of, you know, we have this super European government, and soon we're going to have the super North American government and the Asian Union and the African Union and South American Union. And all this is a penultimate step towards creating, again, not one world government, but rather one world company limited at the expense of people and liberties across the world.
Who will be the chairman of the board, Daniel?
I don't know. You know, in Europe, we have this, you know, a funny-looking guy by the name of Van Rompuy, you know, who is the president of the European community, of,
yeah,
you know, community of 500 million people. Well, you know, this guy, I mean, no one actually knew who he was before he was elected. And one of the people who will be speaking with me, the president of the British Independent Party, Nigel Farage, an amazing man, and you could see him by going to YouTube and actually typing in Nigel Farage and watching his speech, is a great statesman. You know, the day that Van Rompuy was elected, he kind of faced him and said, "Who are you?" He said, "I've never heard of you. You know, I've never seen you. I don't think someone like you will ever stop traffic." When we were expecting, you know, the president, we were told that the president of European Community is going to be a giant, and then it's going to change the course of history. And instead, Nigel said, "We got you."
Daniel, we're going to take this quick break. We'll be right back with you in just a moment as we talk about Shadow Masters. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your phone calls next hour with Daniel Estulin, Shadow Masters, his latest work. We'll talk about that and more about the Bilderbergs on Coast to Coast AM. Daniel, this is an incredible work here, Shadow Masters, and I want to spend some time talking about this, how governments and their intelligence agencies are working with drug dealers and terrorists to benefit, something that we've long suspected. You have finally documented. When you were putting this together, did you fear for your life at all?
Well, in fact, I did. You know, Bilderbergers is, think of it as a, you know, the work lightweight when you talk actually when you compare it to the book The Shadow Masters. I'm not trying to sell Shadow Masters, but actually when you're talking about the planners, you're talking about the Bilderbergers. When you're talking about the doers, you're talking about the Shadow Masters. And you know, Bilderbergers are once removed, but these people, the ones I'm talking about in my new book, The Shadow Masters, the governments, intelligence agencies, international drug dealers, terrorists. You know, I came across a lot of these people face to face with them. I spent a lot of time in Africa, you know, with a camera on my left hand, you know, a Mac 10 in my right hand, documenting what some of these people actually do. I've been to places like Sudan and Darfur and Chad and Congo and Zaire, and I've actually seen how the Hezbollah are working hand in glove with the CIA, you know, doing basically the same thing, you know, digging for, you know, blood diamonds. And the CIA was actually using the diamonds to finance all the dirty operations. And the Hezbollah were actually using to hide their money because, you know, a handful of diamonds is about three, you know, big truckloads of cash. So, you know, there were some very hairy situations where once I literally walked into this, you know, this local mafia. There were about 130 of them, and I have photographs of some of these people in my new book, The Shadow Masters. And there they were digging. I didn't realize they were there, you know, because, you know, they were hidden by this, you know, by this bush, and I didn't even hear them. And there I am, standing alone with a camera, you know, cannon in my left hand and you know, and a gun in my right. And all of them kind of looking at me, just, you know, think about, you know, some Hollywood film. And, you know, I thought to myself, well, I guess this is it, you know, and then I thought, you know, I have, you know, four magazines in my backpack and I got, you know, 30 bullets in this magazine in my hand. I kind of started kind of, you know, backed away from it and was safely made it, you know, out of there. I got in my, you know, 4x4 and got out of there as quickly as I could. But, you know, I never came that close ever. You know, the closest I came was being arrested at the airports during, you know, the years I've been pursuing Bilderberg. So, yes. There's been some hairy situations, and you know, I never told my wife. If I had, you know, she'd keep me.
Oh my God! You know, I've always said the Bilderbergs are people we generally know. The Shadow Masters are people we won't ever know. Pretty accurate.
Exactly. Well, absolutely, you know, because again, you know, we're talking about the local mafia in Congo or in Zaire. You know, who the hell knows these people? No one. But there they are, you know, they're digging for the diamonds and they're actually working as partners in this business with a Hezbollah terrorist and CIA, you know, who's supposedly, you know, looking after America's interests abroad. You know, so go figure, which is again why it's called Shadow Masters, how governments and their intelligence agencies are working with international drug dealers and terrorists for mutual benefit and profit. You know, basically it's just going down the rabbit hole and finding some, you know, some amazing truths, things that I, you know, I really preferred not to have ever found out. But once I did, you just realize how rotten to the core the world is. And it took me quite a while to actually get over the experience.
All right. I have long suspected that there's much more to Osama bin Laden than meets the eye. Beyond the conspiracies, beyond the speculation, is it conceivable that governments or the Shadow Master specifically have been working with this guy?
Well, absolutely. You know, it's been documented even by, you know, in American mainstream press. There's just been so many books written on the subject that Osama bin Laden was actually trained, you know, in Sudan by the CIA. I've seen CIA training camps in Africa because, you know, again, I spent several years in Africa in the 1990s, between 1994 and 1997. You know, my domain was that, you know, the Black Continent. And I've seen some amazing things. You know, we're talking about Sudan, we're talking about Darfur, we're talking about the, you know, the alleged murders committed by the John Jewies. And, you know, I can tell you it's all, you know, a pack of lies. Darfur is about oil, you know, it's about natural resources, which is why you have the United States government is there, the Russians are there, the French are there, the Israelis are there, the British are there, the Chinese are there. You know, this thing about long-lasting relationship, friendship, such as the, you know, Anglo-American relationship, which, you know, goes back, you know, half a century, it actually doesn't exist. You know, talking about right now temporary partnerships for profit. So one day the Russians are working with the Americans. The next day, you know, they're working in the sabotage operations against the Chinese. And the Chinese are working with Israelis. Then the Israelis working with Americans one day and against them the next. And again, it's not something you see on CNN or your local news. You really have to be there. And one of the things about being an embedded reporter is it's like, you know, it's like going on a field trip. You basically are taken to where the Army wants you to see. And that's one of the things I've never done. I've always traveled by myself, with close confidants. I paid for all that stuff myself. And again, some of these experiences, some of these photographs in the Shadow Masters attest to the fact that what I have seen, you know, the American government, I can tell you, is profoundly unhappy by the fact that Shadow Masters came out. As a couple of my sources and my readers in the State Department have told me, they said they're very unhappy that you ever released this book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, where do we go with this, Daniel? Where do we as people, how do we fight this? Can we fight this? Or do we just have to march in tune, just like, you know, little robots?
That's a very, very good question. You know, let's see if I can explain this. 40 years ago, we were living through a major cultural paradigm shift in the generation of university age. Now, those particularly who were going to universities at the time, now, this represented a cultural paradigm shift away from the idea of producer society, which is what the United States had been, the leading example up to that point, and against technology, which is, again, this whole thing about zero growth, zero progress, et cetera. An anti-technology post-industrial movement, of which the most colorful form of the, you know, the rock, drug, sex counterculture. Now, the people who are in their 50s or their early 60s, we call them the baby boomer generation. In other words, you know, even if people are not smoking pot and having sex with strange animals, you know, they're still baby boomers in the sense that most of them accept the values which are common to that generation. And the values which are common to that generation are acceptance of the leading role of cultural policy changes, which have occurred during this 40-year period. Now, again, that policy change is deindustrialization of America, and I don't need to tell you others listening to the show what that means. I mean, you see it, you know, point blank in the United States. Now, the deindustrialization society is a no-future society because any self-respecting nation state can only be truly independent if it can provide welfare for its citizens. Now, we have a very similar universal principle which starts that all modern civilized society, which is called the principle of general welfare, the principle of general welfare in which all modern civilized society is based. Now, what is it about? Now, general welfare doesn't mean some big fat guy sitting in front of the television, eating a slice of pizza, slobbering all over himself while he's waiting for the unemployment check from the government to arrive at our expense. You know, we're talking about some very, you know, high-valued intellectual issues. What is the intention of the existence of man, of the government? Why are we here? What is the meaning of immortality? It's to provide for the welfare of future generations of mankind and the improvement of the universe by virtue of the existence of that mankind. And the principle of the general welfare, again, as expressed in summation in the preamble of the Federal Constitution, is the fundamental law. Now, younger people, you know, who are entering their adulthood during the recent years, you know, they're going to be, you know, from the adolescence to adulthood. You know, they're looking around them in the United States and in Europe, and they say, you know, what we're going through is a no-future society. Mm-hmm. That is what our parent generation has done to us. You know, it's given us a no-future society in which to live. So therefore, you know, you had a conflict between young adults, that is people who are young, but who think like adults. You know, they don't like, you know, they don't look and think like adolescents or children. So they say, well, I'm not going to accept it. You know, I don't care what my parents tell me to do. I'm not going to go there. I don't want that place. You know, I'm going to change things if possible. So the younger generation represents a potentially healthy generation for turning society back away from the no-future society perspective. Whether it's the older generation is embedded with habits of thinking, prejudices, knee-jerk reactions, emotional reflexes, all these things which would prevent a future for the younger generation and their children. You know, and in my book, The Shadow Masters, I dedicate the book, you know, to these people. And I think, you know, I say dedicated to all those who refuse to accept the spectacle of human misery and injustice as part of the norm. To the next generation who with pride and confidence have fiercely picked up the mantle and accepted the challenge. We'll leave it in your hands. Your humanity's last hope, the potential of the planet Earth, is its future reality. And then I say, we'll win this war and a shadow master's new dark age be damned. So again, our future is in the hands of the younger generation coming up today. We have to make sure they understand what they're up against. We have to educate them. We have to give them the tools, the intellectual tools, you know, the moral tools to fight this injustice. Because again, unfortunately, too many people, you know, they're 50 and above, have basically have given up and basically have accepted what has been given to them. And again, this is a no future generation. There are no quick answers. There are no, you know, red or blue pills. It's a very long fight. And actually, the fight itself is about 2,500 years old. It's always been between the classical culture, you know, the Socratic and Platonic culture on one hand, and Aristotle and his degenerates on the other hand, who believe that a very small portion of the population, you know, are born to be leaders, and the rest of us are born to be slaves.
One of the players in your book, Shadow Masters, is a fellow by the name of Viktor Bout, a Russian arms dealer. Tell me about him.
You know, this is, again, another amazing story. You know, when the United States government, again, I've been told this by very, very good sources and very good friends in the American government. Now, when the CIA, when they put their, you know, what-if scenarios, you know, in their planning sessions, when they were actually working on the Boot story, the last thing that had occurred to them, you know, that me, Daniel Estrell, the man who has for years been pursuing, you know, secret government, you know, the private secret societies such as the Bilderbergers, Trilateral Commission, you know, spending years investigating, you know, the roots of the Bilderbergers going back to the Middle Ages. The last thing that I had thought that would actually get on the plane one good day, you know, go to Bangkok and spend 6 months of my life finishing my book, The Shadow Masters, actually working on the Viktor Bout story. And this is exactly what I had done, because it was a key element, the missing link to actually show how Bilderbergers through these Shadow Masters are working to control the world. Now, Viktor Bout's story, you know, we all heard, I'm sure you've seen the film, The Lord of War with Nicolas Cage.
Right.
Have you not?
Right. Good movie.
Well, you know, exactly. You know, now, Viktor Bout is the poster boy for a new generation of the post-Cold War international arms dealers, we're told, who play a critical role in areas where the weapons trade has been embargoed by the United Nations. But again, I can tell you from my years in Africa, it is simply not true. Viktor Bout was selling arms, yes. He was selling, you know, selling ostriches, ostrich eggs, elephants. You know, an arms trade is not illegal. You know, I'm not defending the guy because we are certainly not friends. But, you know, we've been told that Viktor Bout, more than most, has succeeded in exploiting the anarchy of globalization, making possible massacres on a scale that has stunned the world. And the Viktor Bout story actually begins back in 1991. When the Soviet Union fell apart, Viktor Bout was working as a translator in Mozambique in the Russian embassy there. Instead of going back to Russia, he just stayed in Africa. And because he was always into transporting and he loved airplanes, he and his brother Sergei, they bought a couple of old Antonov 24s, which is, you know, you could buy one, you know, the secondhand for about $250,000, you know, which is, you know, a price of a, you know, mid-range Mercedes, which is really not a lot of money. And they basically started moving, you know, things from point A to point B, you know, big gladiolas, which were, you know, buying for a dollar in South Africa and selling for $100 a piece in Dubai, to ostriches, to anything that they could actually get their hands on, anything that their clients wanted, they were moving. Now, also about 1993, 1994, 1995, the entire continent of Africa was ablaze in regional and local conflicts. Out of the 53 countries, 32 were at war. So all these Western companies, such as, you know, the American Airlines, you know, the British Airlines, they all pulled out, obviously, you know, fearing for the lives, for the safety of their crews and for their airplanes. So the entire black continent was left to their devices. So these people, a billion people in Africa, were suddenly stranded. They had no access to medicine. They had no access to clothes. They had no access to anything at all until this Viktor Bout character, you know, and his kamikaze pilots, mm-hmm. you know, who lost their jobs when the Soviet Union fell apart, they stepped in. And for actually, you know, a very reasonable rate, they actually started moving, you know, medicine, clothes, food to people all over the continent. And by about 1996, Viktor Bout came to control 90% of African continent. It's just a mega monopoly. Not even Bill Gates and Microsoft ever had a mega monopoly of this size. And when the war started to subside towards the end of 1996, and all these Western corporations and governments wanted to come back, they suddenly found themselves in a situation where this one, you know, speculating Ruski by the name of Victor Boot controlled the entire continent. You know, and keeping in mind that Africa is the breadbasket of the entire planet.
Sure.
You know, it's full of natural resources, coltan, gold, diamonds, you know, oil, natural gas.
Well, now, he supplied arms to the Taliban, anybody who would buy them, didn't he?
Well, you know, actually, no, that's not true. And in my book, The Shadow Masters, you know, I basically, you know, explode the, you know, the myth that Victor Boot has ever worked with the Taliban. Well, the whole story with Boot is that the American government, working, you know, hand in glove with some very unscrupulous United Nations inspectors, you know, and a very important American journalist by the name of Douglas Fair, not to mention the DEA, you know, and other international agencies such as Interpol, have actually put together this mega conspiracy to ensnare the guy. For what reason? There are actually several reasons.
He's been indicted, though, Daniel, hasn't he?
He's been indicted, but he actually won the case in Brussels, and he just won the case. He's in prison in Thailand. He was arrested in March 2008, and he won the court case against the United States government, who actually showed up in court with no evidence at all. You know, the whole thing about Victor Boot is they needed to get him out of Africa because you can't start wars. You can't get at natural resources. You can't get your, you know, NGOs, non-governmental organizations on the ground unless you can actually control the territory. And Victor Boot controlled the entire continent. So they created this amazing diversion. But when he was arrested in Bangkok, and again, I spent the last year living in Bangkok. I just came back to Spain a couple of months ago. I can tell that, you know, when he was arrested in March 2008 with this co-conspirator Andrew Smolyan, he was guarded by 20. And this is again, this is the kinds of things that never come out of the American press. He was guarded by 20 commandos. He and Smolyan. Next thing we know, Smolyan, who is his co-conspirator, one day later finds himself in the United States. Now we've been told that he escaped, and he was luckily caught by the United States government. Now, this is a man who was. You know, he was handcuffed and guarded by 20 commandos plus DEA in a lockdown hotel. This is a conspiracy. A lockdown hotel in the center of Bangkok, and I got the photographs in my book. The entire hotel perimeter was guarded by 200 special forces troops because, again, you know, think of Victor Boot, you know, as an Osama bin Laden because, you know, Osama bin Laden has disappeared, unless we believe that, you know, the bad actor who shows up once in a while on television is
right.
Osama bin Laden. So Victor Boot has become the number one, you know, terrorist on America's list. So this is a guy, Andrew Smolyan. So the hotel is locked down. Just think of a five-star luxury hotel. You have 200 special forces troops guarding the hotel with tanks and dogs. Every stairwell, you know, is guarded by special forces troops. Smolyan and Boot are each guarded by 20 commandos each. And all these photographs are in my book. They're handcuffed, needless to say. Their passports are taken away. And the American government wants us to believe that Smolyan, you know, a short, fat guy, somehow escapes, flips his guard without anybody noticing, makes his way out of a lockdown hotel, flags a taxi, handcuffed. You know, goes to the airport without a taxi driver noticing that this guy is handcuffed and buys a ticket without a passport, handcuffed to the only place in the world that, if convicted, is destined to spend 300 years in a slammer. When I called the DEA agent in charge in Washington and I asked him this, he said, yep, you know, this is the, you know, the official version. I said to him, you know, and you called me a conspiracy theorist.
Jeez. Well, Daniel, let me tell you that is he as arms-worthy as Adnan Khashoggi was for Saudi Arabia?
No, not at all. Victor Boot is a patsy. I mean, he's small fry. But he just happened to have been in Africa at the worst possible time when America needed the natural resources. They needed gold. They needed diamonds. They needed to control the entire territory. They needed to get out of the oil in Sudan. You know, and as I said to you before, they were in Congo working with the terrorists of Hezbollah, you know, working on the diamond trade.
Hey,
you
Daniel.
Can't have a big... there.
We're going to take this quick break and come back and take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.